UTC right after the international news.
Hello and a warm welcome to you. I'm Heidi Adams. This is Straight Talk Africa. And this week, we take a closer look at informal settlements. Will they always be a part of African cities? Should they be upgraded and made more livable? Or should permanent housing for all be the goal? We'll also speak to one of Africa's most famous mayors, Yvonne Akie-Sawyer, about her quest to transform her city of Freetown, Sierra Leone. Plus, we'll bring you the story of a Nigerian-American property developer who turned his housing challenge into a multi-million dollar housing business opportunity. How did he do it? How's it going? And how is he making city living more accessible? We've got a great show lined up for you. Straight Talk Africa starts now. It's estimated a quarter of the world's urban population lives in informal settlements. That's about 1 billion people. In Africa, they're a feature of nearly every metropolis. About 200 million people live in some kind of informal housing or unplanned community. As Africa's cities evolve and grow in size and population, where will everyone live? That's a question in Kenya, where residents of the Mukurukwa Njenga informal settlement are being uprooted from their homes to make way for the new Chinese-backed Nairobi Expressway. Rights groups are pushing the government there to resettle tens of thousands of people who were evicted ahead of the festive season last year. Activists say infrastructure development should take into account people's dignity. Brenda Mulinya brings us the story from Nairobi.
There is little cheer for Lucy Wangari and scores of Kenyans like her from the Mukurukwa Njenga slum, spending cold and wet nights living in makeshift tents. City authorities in October began evicting more than 40,000 squatters and raising their homes to make way for construction of the Nairobi Expressway. Authorities gave them just days' notice, despite many like Wangari calling the area home for 18 years.
If you look at where I sleep, you think I wasn't a Kenyan citizen. You think I'm a refugee. We had houses, we had property, but right now we've been left destitute, all because of the government of Kenya.
The $500 million elevated expressway aims to ease Nairobi's notorious traffic by connecting the main international airport to the city center and wealthy suburbs. The Chinese state-owned China Road and Bridge Corporation is building and financing the expressway, which should be working in 2022 and will collect the tolls for nearly three decades. Despite critics calling it a road for the rich, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has defended the project.
The difference that is being occasioned by the road building, by the drainage being put in, by the sewage being put in, I do believe that within another 2 years, Nairobi will be a truly 21st century city, catering for its population in a positive manner and in a manner befitting our people.
But rights activists fault the government for not striking a balance between the need for infrastructure and human dignity for those evicted.
It's so traumatizing. People are having mental issues here. We have other special challenges here. They should get like special attention, but you find out that even the facilities that we have around, they can't maybe even accommodate or maybe to create that space to provide such services to the people here.
The squatters left homeless struggle with security fears.
It's very dangerous here, especially for us women. The men can defend themselves if attacked, but I can't fight anyone. If someone attacks me and steals my property, tells me to leave, I have no choice but to obey them.
City authorities' promises to help resettle the evicted families have yet to come true. Brenda Mulinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
Well, scenes like these are playing out around the world. So what is the solution? Should informal settlements be upgraded? Should those living in so-called unplanned communities be relocated and offered better housing? Earlier, I spoke to Ugandan urban economist Astrid Haas about the issue. She believes there are ways to make informal housing better. Haas is based in Kampala, but joined me from Vienna, Austria. Astrid, so glad you're here. Thank you so much for joining me. We've just watched an example of the kinds of scenes that often play out in a number of cities on the continent and in many parts of the world too. People living in informal settlements, and they're seeing evictions, their homes demolished, bulldozed under various pretexts. I mean, in this case, of course, to make way for roads and bridges. Now, Astrid, as African cities continue to develop and urbanize, I guess we're likely to see only more of this type of displacement and of informal communities inside our cities?
So, Hedy, what we're very much likely to see, or what we're definitely going to see, is a large number of people moving to cities. We know that in the next 30 years, Africa's cities are set to grow quite large, and a large number of people are going to move there. However, what we have seen in the clip beforehand is something that we can actually avoid, and we have the opportunity to avoid, because two-thirds of African cities, or the built environment of two-thirds of cities, are yet to come in the next 30 years. And so to be able to avoid what we've seen is about building infrastructure before people settle. Not only does this remove the financial cost of having to retrofit, which we know from evidence can be about three times higher than building the infrastructure first, most importantly, it removes the social cost of having to uproot people and their livelihoods, as we've seen in the clip beforehand. Even more importantly, planning for these settlements before people come also has the impact that we can have populations settle in a more orderly manner. And if you have the infrastructure there, we avoid some of the pitfalls that we've seen about through unplanned settlements in this pandemic. Many of the settlements don't have water and sewage infrastructure, for example, partially because it's very difficult to build that once people have been settled. You know, if you built the water and sewage infrastructure first, whilst obviously still costly, it eliminates the need to have to move people to build it. And secondly, with more orderly settlement, you can ensure that people are not living as densely as they are now, in a way that would allow for social distancing and other part of the COVID SOP measures that are just impossible to do now in many of these places.
And of course, Astrid, at the heart of the conversation around informal settlements is land. The land that people's structures are built on, because they don't own it, and that deprives them of security of tenure, and these communities face so many vulnerabilities.
No, that's very much the case, and it is a challenge across African cities. I mean, in my own city in Kampala, we have four concurrent land tenure systems in one city, which exacerbates tenure insecurity. And this has social costs. And I think what the clip also shows very well is that these social costs are even more pertinent for women and the most vulnerable populations in cities who have even less tenure security. But I think as well, we've got to think about, for a growing city like Nairobi or Kampala or any other city in Africa, it doesn't even make economic sense to have such tenure insecurity, because the private sector is also not going to want to invest if it can't guarantee that its investments aren't taken away or bulldozed in that way. So, you know, being able to ensure more tenure security not only makes social sense, but it also makes economic sense for rapidly urbanizing cities.
Now, you speak at conferences around the world, and you wrote a brief recently which really piqued my interest. You asked, can we do informal housing better? Astrid, first tell me, what constitutes informal housing in our cities, and should we not be envisioning a future in which we do away with informal housing and really offer people something better, more secure housing options?
The answer is undoubtedly yes. We should not be thinking about a future with informal housing. I think the point that I'm trying to make with the brief, though, is that the gap between the formal housing stock and the needs of the populations that are moving to cities, as well as the needs of the population or residing cities, is just growing exponentially. And governments and the private sector cannot keep up with the housing supply at the moment, the supply of adequate and affordable housing. Now, what do I mean by informal housing? informal housing here very much refers to pretty much any housing that doesn't meet building and planning standards of the city that it's in, which is in some cases really the majority of housing in African cities. It's estimated, for example, in the past decade, over 70% of the housing that has been built in Nairobi has been in informal settlements. And this is one of the big challenges. So what I'm trying to argue in the brief is not that we should have more informal settlements, but can we do informal settlements better so that we can upgrade, we can make sure that they start meeting formal standards so that it provides sort of the interim step that the informal stock actually becomes the formal, adequate and affordable supply stock, as opposed to doing away with it completely, because actually right now it's what provides the most housing for people in African cities.
Now, you also talk about incremental housing. What does that mean?
So it's one of the solutions that I propose in the brief. So I propose three solutions that come under the sort of broader framework that governments should be enablers by ensuring that regulation is adequate and that building codes and planning codes are adequate. So one of the challenges of why much of this housing stock doesn't meet planning codes is because they're just out of date and they're not locally appropriate. And so three ways this can be done is the first way, as you just mentioned, is through really enabling incremental housing to be formal. A lot of the housing that is already built is built incrementally. What does this mean? It means that people build as soon as and when they have the funds to do so, and they build on as and when they have the funds to do so. So it's not that, you know, suddenly there's a final house because everyone has all the money to build a final house or a final apartment. It's that over time, as money is made, you can add to the house. Now, under most planning codes, this doesn't actually constitute formal housing, or because it's not complete. And so being able to enable regulation so that actually when, you know, the fundamentals are there of a house, that it actually constitutes complete house already brings a lot of housing into the stock, into the formal housing stock. And this can be, there's, you know, even bigger experiments that can be done where, for example, in Iquique in Chile, with $7,500, a partnership between the private sector and the government managed to build sort of what they called half houses. So the private sector built the foundations, and then people could incrementally build on that as and when they had the funds to do so. The second area is that construction costs are extremely high in Africa compared to the rest of the world. And that's also because of the building material that's allowed by formal planning and building codes. And so one way to overcome this, like was done in 2019 in Rwanda, in the revisions of their building codes, is to really allow for locally produced material. And the building code in Rwanda talks about indigenous and local knowledge as part of the building structure that can be part of the formally planned structure. And then I think the final part, or one of the final pieces that I highlight in this brief, is to enable micro builders. So who are micro builders? Well, they're anyone really, individuals, families, and they own and they build a lot of these tenements in informal settlements. And they build usually from what they can save. And the reason they have to build from what they can save is because what they build is not considered formal. And so they cannot go to a bank and, for example, take a loan and build better. So how do we make regulations and standards that really enable these micro builders to meet them and to build better dwellings, both in terms of health and regulation and safety standards, but then also on the flip side, when meeting them, be constituted as formal so they can then, for example, go and get a loan that they can then sort of expand their stock further.
You also say governments alone should not be responsible for providing housing. Why not?
Simply because they cannot be, just given what the demands are at the moment versus what the resources are. So social housing has been very popular, or government-provided social housing, I should clarify, has been very popular and very successful across many countries around the globe. But this is really only where social housing has provided a social safety net and has been provided to a small portion of the population. What we're talking about in African cities is really the majority of the populations that are in the cities and moving to cities. And it's very unlikely that any government, let alone a government that is very resource constrained, could provide housing at this scale. And that's why I talk about the government as an enabler, because, you know, doing regulation well is relatively financially cheap than trying to actually do the sort of brick and mortar in the building. And so how can you unleash the private sector to be able to do what they're already doing, but do it better?
Astrid, just going back to the story that we saw earlier, when we see infrastructure development projects in African cities, so in this case, of course, this was investment by the Chinese, why are we not seeing homes being built instead of roads and bridges and then in the places where people actually live? Why are we not building homes as part of economic development and as part of infrastructure development?
So one of the challenges really, Haiti, is where we've seen governments try to build homes, they haven't been able to do so that is in an affordable and adequate manner. And actually also the housing supply has been so small that those who are moving into these government built homes are not the poorest, but in fact, the middle class who are also lacking housing. The other part is where governments have looked at building housing, they've really done it for ownership purposes and trying to get people to own housing. And that's how they sort of repay and be able to take up mortgages, et cetera. However, when we look at the demographic of African cities, especially the demographic of the cities yet to come in the next 30 years, they're primarily youth who are looking to find a job and need the flexibility to be able to move around the city where the job is and don't necessarily want to own because they would like to rent and have that flexibility. At the same time, another phenomenon of African urbanization is the very much the sort of very strong rural urban links. You'll often find that people have a house in the city where they want to work, but a home in their rural area. And so they see their sort of stay in the city more as temporary during their sort of either their working population age or whilst their kids are at school. But actually where they want to invest in their home is in a rural area. So again, they're not necessarily looking to own in the city. They're looking to rent. So then the question is also, how do we increase the rental stock? And a lot of government provided housing or examples of government provided housing haven't really focused on doing this piece, but rather have focused on improving ownership. And so I think where the private sector really has a comparative advantage is both it's already doing this, maybe it's not doing it adequately, but it's also providing the rental stock allows people the flexibility to maintain different homes through the course of their stay in the city.
Now we're going to have to leave it there. Astrid Haas is a Ugandan urban economist speaking to us from Vienna, Austria. Astrid, always great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for breaking it all down for us, and thank you for your time.
Welcome. Thank you. Take care, Edie. Bye.
Now, our cameraman, Charles Kombe, in Tanzania, visited residents living in two informal settlements in Dar es Salaam. He asked residents there what they think should be done to make life in their area better.
The big challenge is health affairs. If a person gets sick, it is difficult for them to get a transport service quickly, and also for emergency cars such as an ambulance or even doctors to reach this area. Usually, people have been physically carrying patients to take them to the open area where cars can access. What needs to be done is to focus on infrastructure, including widening roads, because many roads here are so narrow and they cannot allow cars or rickshaws to pass through and reach people who need help. What I need the world to know is that healthcare is very problematic. We have patients who are sick at home with no medical attention. It should be required to have mobile doctors or emergency services such as first aid. For instance, if someone is involved in an accident and needs help, often they may lose their life while waiting on the road.
In the area where we live, when it rains, it's a challenge. There are lots of floods and water spreads all over the place. What needs to be done is to strengthen the infrastructure so that the challenges we face are not as many and we will be able to live peacefully.
I need our government to maintain our roads so that the garbage trucks can reach these areas and to build tunnels to channel wastewater. What I can tell the world is that this is a good place to live, but we ask the government to help us.
The big challenge here is that many people are alcoholics and drug users. We live in a crowded area and have children who may be attracted to engage in those bad habits such as smoking and drug use. I would like our police officers to patrol and arrest alcoholics and drug users. If they decrease, I think our streets would be safe and clean. I want the world to know that we need improvements in our infrastructure. We need to eradicate alcoholism since we have young children and we don't want them to copy these bad behaviors.
And we also conducted a poll on social media. We asked whether governments should tear down informal settlements and give people better options elsewhere. 86% of you said yes and 14% said no. And I'm going to read a couple of the social media comments that came with that poll about what governments should do with informal settlements in their cities. Andre Kutsos says, all government officials must go live in those informal settlements for at least 6 months before taking office. Then they will feel the pain. Emmanuel Kwame Nunu says, yes, of course, government needs to prioritize the plight of these informal communities, working on their settlements to make them a more convenient place to live. People are already established in these settlements. Neglecting them comes with an additional societal burden, such as increased crime and poverty. The best option is to formalize these settlements. Emmanuel's comment there very much in line with what our expert said earlier. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, my conversation with the mayor of Freetown, Sierra Leone, Yvonne Akisoya. She talks about her mission to transform her city. She says she has the personal and political will to do it. And you don't hear that often. And later on in the show, we'll take you on a trip around town with a Nigerian-American property developer who built an $840 million real estate business building affordable homes in Washington. That's still ahead here on Straight Talk Africa. Stay with us. Back in a moment.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on VOA. Welcome back. She's arguably one of Africa's most famous mayors and one of Sierra Leone's most powerful women. Yvonne Akisoya is the mayor of Freetown, and she's on a quest to transform her city, especially the lives of those in informal communities. She says she has the personal and political will to make it happen. Akisoya is, of course, no stranger to challenges. She campaigned against the blood diamond trade, advocated for ending Sierra Leone's civil war. In 2016, she was awarded a gold medal by the president of Sierra Leone for her contribution to the country's Ebola response efforts. She was also made an officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire by the Queen of England in 2016. Hollywood actor Idris Elba is also a big fan. But accolades and famous friends aside, Akisoya says she wants to restore the glory of the city where she was born and raised. She spoke to me from Freetown.
My name is Yvonne Akisoya, and I'm the mayor of Freetown. I assumed office in May 2018 with a commitment to work with Freetonians and our stakeholders to ensure that we transformed our city, to ensure that we addressed some of the most challenging problems which have plagued us for decades. We pulled together, we created the Transform Freetown Agenda.
Many of the very well-known leaders across the whole region, Ghana, Nigeria, Gambia, they all schooled. In fact, even when I was at university, because I'm a bit old, I was in university from 84 to 88. We still had a lot of students coming from the Gambia, from Cameroon, other parts of the region. But certainly in those early days, this was the center of learning. And amazing, amazing minds and professional scientists, historians, came from or came through Furby College. And just speaking back to childhood, just thinking about it, perhaps for me, what stands out most in contrast, and I know time doesn't stand still, right? Nothing stays the same forever. So that you've got to sort of temper one's nostalgia with reality. Things move and things change. But perhaps what's most striking in terms of the change has been the population growth. And because that population growth has not come into a city where there were any development controls, the impact has been catastrophic. Growing up as a girl, the hills were covered in trees. Our backyard, you know, going to school, you walked through the forest, you know, the weekends you were fishing, you know, in the woods behind with the streams, the beach, Lomley Beach. After school, a classic thing my sisters and I would do would be to go nag our dad to take us swimming after school, because you it's such an amazing place to grow up in a city where you've got the beach at your doorstep, you've got the mountains, you've got the forest. And that was it. I suppose another recollection, which is really tied into this, was just the way everybody knew everybody else. When I was at university in my penultimate year, we hosted an ISEC conference, ISEC being the International Association of Students in Economics and Management. It was the first time we'd done it, and you know, I spearheaded that. And I remember one of the participants, who was Dutch, being in town with me and saying, you know, everybody here, because it was a small enough, I suppose it was a city, but it was, I guess it's what people would think of a town, where everybody knows everybody else. So, you know, fast forward the war, a huge explosion in the population, and like I said, in an uncontrolled manner, which has just devastated the woods, devastated the coastline, the mangroves. It's been really destructive.
So, Madam Mayor, having all these mixed memories of wonder and of tragedy, how do you reconcile what you see in Freetown today and what you see for the city's future?
The thing about migration, whether it's international or rural, urban rural, is when migration happens, the best thing that you can do is to embrace where you are and seek to ensure that everybody has an improved standard of living. So Freetown is never going to be that small little city anymore. I mean, it's, you know, that time has passed. And so how I feel about it is a determination to ensure that as best as possible, you know, the things that went wrong that created this urban sprawl, destruction of forests, of mangroves, of education, lack of access to health and everything else, that in running the city now, that one is really constructively seeking to address these challenges within the context of our current reality. What you do with sanitation impacts what you do with health. What you do with health impacts what you do with economic productivity, you know, with job creation. The environment certainly impacts on our resilience, on urban planning and housing, you know, affects water, it affects sanitation. It even affects education, because if you don't organize a city, then you can't deliver services efficiently. And invariably, in many cases, you can't deliver services at all. So my approach, looking at it, what do I make of it? How do I respond? I respond with knowing that it can be different. It's never going to be what it was, but it can be, this city has intrinsic beauty. It's still it's still a wonderful place to be. And being able to draw out the good, being able to advocate for land use planning and building permit to come back to the city, for it to be managed at city level. We've not had an urban plan in the city for over 40 years. We need to fix that, because as we continue to grow, we need to grow into a structured environment. And we need to do as we're doing now with the CBD regeneration, the Central Business District regeneration. We need to see how we can back solve. So yes, the CBD is dead or dying. So many of the buildings are inaccessible, there's street trading everywhere, really dilapidated. But we've been able to secure funding from, you know, our colleagues, our sister city, to be able to improve that. So doing a local area plan, engaging the property owners, ensuring that we fix the drains, we fix the roads, we bring in lighting, we introduce a controlled parking zone. So we see the ability to say, yes, you know, you can take the city in pockets, but for the areas where there's still hope, you can ensure that you bring in local area plans so you don't have this uncontrolled development. Certainly for our 35% of our residents who already live in informal settlements, live in slums, because there was a terrible fire, homes were destroyed. Because again, as we discussed as a community, I discussed with them, there's no road. No road whatsoever. So the fire force can't get up there. You know it, I know it, but why has it happened? Because building has gone on in an uncontrolled manner. Building permits are a nice thing to talk about, but they don't really exist. I mean, when you look at what the auditor recently did, a survey or a study on building permits, the building permits system in the city, and the building permits are held by the Ministry of Lands, and they found that 85% of the properties in the city didn't have building permits. So what does that tell you? It means that somebody can build a 5-story building with no bathrooms, with no toilets. And that creates a huge sanitation challenge, which the city needs to pick up. So what do I see? I see us implementing Transform Freetown, which is this integrated approach to urban development. I see as one of the key factors that needs to be changed and that we continue to advocate for, because it's actually a legal mandate devolved to the city for us to be responsible for local, for land use planning and building permits. It's something I will continue to talk about, because as I say constantly, our inability to plan will result in an inability to deliver services. And that has a very negative impact on the city in terms of the life of the city, but also in terms of the lives of the city's residents.
And resilience is also about beautifying our city. And Aberdeen Roundabout is testament to that. And sweeping the streets daily. 68 key streets in the city are now swept, as are our markets. This makes a significant difference to the way Freetown feels, the way Freetown looks, and to all our health outcomes. And with the tricycles now collecting waste from households, it's really important that they don't have to travel long distances. That way, they get to collect more from more homes, and it also discourages illegal dumping. So the transfer stations are designed to produce, to provide that function. We're really pleased that the transfer stations at Macaulay Street and Kleintown have been completed. There's so much going on with Transform Freetown. We couldn't be doing it without you all.
And of course, we all know a big part of getting that sort of buy-in from communities is about messaging. How do you explain your Transform Freetown agenda to the people in your city? Do they share your vision? And what do they tell you about what they really need and what their desires are?
One of our key messages, one of my key messages, is always something which everybody can relate to and everybody can do something about, and that's sanitation, keeping the city clean. For their health reasons, for our health reasons, for resources, so we're not spending inordinate amounts of money clearing gutters, which we could be using, you know, providing tables and chairs for our schools. But how do I get the message across? Try really to talk to people through different media, not just myself, through stakeholders, through community influencers. For me, it's about messaging where you really hook your message into people's reality, and at the same time as accepting our responsibility as a city leadership, making sure there's a sense of accepting the responsibility that residents also have to have in how we deal with the challenges and not exacerbate them, not allow them to continue to get worse. We're in a world where the pressures that bear down on progress are constant and significant. And you've got to be able to be in a place where you are joining the dots enough and you're creating enough momentum on the positives so that overall you're making more progress than you're being pushed backwards. And that's not easy to do. And the only way it can be done is by really bringing everyone on board, residents, partners, the private sector, and making it not just a thing you talk about, but a thing that actually happens.
Now, you say you want to make Freetown a destination city using an inclusive approach. How do you build a city that is inclusive, where people don't have to feel like they are what's wrong with a city because they live in what's perceived to be the problem areas? I mean, I grew up in an African destination city, Cape Town, spent my life in the shadows of a world famous mountain. But I also grew up in a high crime area, you know, with poor housing, poor services. You know, these are parts of the city you wouldn't see in the travel catalogs, places that nobody really wanted to invest in or visit if they didn't have to. So how do you ensure the city benefits not only those who are visiting there, but also for those who are already living there?
So for me, I'm building a city not for the infrastructure, but for the people. And that means all the people, because you really cannot have prosperity, which is sustainable and which is enjoyable, if it's not something that is available to all, which means creating life opportunities and chances for everyone. If you look at the work that we do in Transform Freetown, we target the informal settlements, we target the vulnerable, we target them a lot. When we look at urban housing and planning, we're looking at 5,000 affordable homes. We're not looking at building the nice, beautiful condominiums that, you know, private sector could do. We're looking at what can we do to lift up more people. When we talk about skills training and we talk about functional literacy, you know, we're talking about people who are illiterate. So it's not your middle class. It's those who didn't have an opportunity. When we talk about the reduction of maternal mortality, we recognize that most of the women who are going to die in childbirth are women who can't access healthcare or won't access healthcare because of misconceptions, because of costs, because of our own lack of doctors and so forth. So in solving the issues around sanitation and environment, you cannot engage people on abstract things when their day-to-day is not being addressed. So Transform Freetown really is looking, my heart, the root, sanitation and environment, that was like the driver. That's what I thought I could fix in the city. But coming into the city, you realize, you know, you can't do that in a silo. You can't do that in isolation. The people's lives have to be improved and changed in order for, you know, us to make progress with sanitation and environment, and in order for us to make progress overall as a city.
I am super, super excited about the opening of the first of our FCC Early Learning Adventure Centers. These are free, quality preschool nursery facilities for the children of market women. And we've opened the first at Congo Water Market in Wellington. The next is coming on at Crewtown Road Market, and there are series to follow. Freetown, the Tree Town. Our commitment to plant 1 million trees and re-green the hillsides of Freetown is underway.
And when you look, Madam Mayor, at other cities in your part of the continent or other parts of Africa, what do you think African cities are getting right? And what, in your view, are they getting wrong?
One thing which is, it's something I said earlier, I believe passionately now, and I didn't know this when I ran for mayor, it wasn't on my radar. And I think this is true of many cities. It's something we've got to get right collectively, or we're just not going to succeed. We're going to fail our populations. We're going to fail our residents if we continue to grow in this uncontrolled manner. So what I think is underemphasized, doesn't get enough airtime, doesn't get enough funding, doesn't get enough attention, is urban planning. And like I said before, you also have these uncontrolled, this is a real feature of African cities, the uncontrolled urban sprawl, many times leading to informal settlements, the creation of informal settlements, where it's difficult to access for sanitation, for the provision of health services, education. We have a mushrooming of things that are called, institutions that are called community schools. They're very, very poorly run, very poor infrastructure. Sometimes, you know, just the corrugated sheeting, inevitably unqualified teachers. But why do they spring up? Because children find themselves living in communities that were unplanned. And so there's no access. And if you can't get access and you want to access education, then the parents come together and they say, well, let's create a school. And wouldn't it be so much better if we were in communities that were planned so that we know we are actually investing in schools that children can access because there are roads, because there are transportation networks, as opposed to us having this situation, which is sadly all too common in many of our cities, of residents trying to find their own solutions. Africa has a problem because we have not, cities like mine, my city was established in 1893, the city council, 1893. The city of Freetown was founded in 1792. But in the 70s, after the end of the colonial period, with the one-party state, the city councils were disbanded. I mean, you no longer had mayors, you had committees of management who weren't elected, they were appointed. And the diversity of experience across the continent, you know, you have cities like Monrovia, where the mayor is appointee, same with Accra, you know, so it's a very different dynamic to a situation where you run for an elected office as mayor, as we have now in Sierra Leone, in not just in Freetown, but, you know, across the country, and which is also the case in other parts of the continent, in other countries. But we don't have a homogenic sort of landscape of city leadership, city management, and along with that, there's no homogeneity, you wouldn't expect it to be, but we're a long way away from it in terms of legislation. What are the mandates of cities? When you're in the West, you know, there's some things which are pretty much taken for granted. You're going to expect that the city is responsible for land use planning and building permits. You're going to expect they're responsible for education at some level. You're going to expect that they're responsible for sanitation. You're going to expect that they have responsibilities at some level for housing, also for revenue mobilization. There's just some things which are given. Street parking, you know, these things are given. You come to our continent and city by city, you know, country by country, you find that these givens, which have really helped cities in other parts of the world to thrive, function, grow, and have the resources to invest in development, you find that these are often lacking with the attendant consequences of an inability to grow at the same pace and to overcome some of the challenges that our residents face.
And that was Yvonne Aki-Sawyer, the mayor of Freetown, speaking to me from Sierra Leone. Coming up, that Nigerian-American I told you about who built an $840 million real estate business, making homes more affordable and accessible in one of America's most expensive cities. Well, he took us on a trip around Washington to show us what he's built and how he did it. You don't want to miss this story. Stay with us. Welcome back. Bua Benitie came to the United States from Nigeria as a young student. He had dreams of finding success in the major cities of America. But finding an affordable place to live, well, that was a nightmare. So he turned his housing challenge into an $840 million housing business. This is his story, filmed and produced by Karina Chowdhury.
You could say business and buildings are hardwired into Bua Benitie's DNA. He knew he wanted to be an entrepreneur like his father, but never imagined he would make a multi-million dollar mark in Washington, D.C. real estate. We meet Benitie at an apartment complex his company built in the District of Columbia's Shaw neighborhood. He tells me his path to success was a winding one that began in one of Africa's most populous and expensive cities.
It was great. It was fantastic growing up in Lagos. Just sort of having a family of entrepreneurs around, you know, just a lively. Lagos is a very enterprising place to be, right? So everybody has a hustle. Everybody's trying to survive in a very sort of bustling, also expensive city, and everyone is trying to provide for their family.
So you've known the hustle from a young age?
From a very early age, right? It's the one place where everybody's resourceful, no matter what. But also everybody has aspirations, right? My parents, you know, they instill very strong work ethic in me and my siblings. But more importantly, we needed to have deep desire to succeed for ourselves as well.
I had read that you had dreams of becoming the next Mark Zuckerberg.
Yes.
How did that work out for you?
Not so well.
Benitie jokes that failure in San Francisco's tech startup world led him to make a fresh start in the U.S. capital, where he persuaded a real estate company to take a chance on him.
And that's how I end up coming to D.C. and working for this real estate consulting firm. And that's when, you know, like you know how Spider-Man became Spider-Man, how he got, you know, bitten by the spider?
Right. Yeah.
Benitie was bitten by the real estate bug, but he was living in a very expensive American city. He says as a young professional, he felt priced out of the real estate market and struggled to find an affordable place to live.
I've lived in very expensive cities, right? So I went to school in New York. I lived in San Francisco, lived in L.A., and lived in D.C. And for whatever reason, particularly when I lived in San Francisco, even after making very decent income, I could not afford to find a place that I could live by myself. And I think that that's still the case for a lot of folks who want to live in, you know, densely populated urban cities. You know, you have to find a roommate. You have to sort of, you know, pay more than 50% of your income to survive. And, you know, and if you're living hand to mouth, which I did, you know, paycheck to paycheck, it's kind of hard. I experienced that myself firsthand.
Benitie channeled that experience into a business opportunity, making city living more accessible. In 2005, he founded Dante's Partners, a boutique real estate development firm focused on affordable housing in the District of Columbia.
It means I get to build multifamily housing, rental property similar to where we're sitting in today, and provide it to people of moderate income, you know, because they don't have any options as far as housing choices are concerned.
Affordable homes don't have to look and feel cheap. Benitie's company has developed thousands of modern apartment units for low and middle income communities, including seniors and young professionals. Affordable housing is in short supply in Washington. The city is ranked among the most intensely gentrified and most expensive places to live in America. A 2018 report by the National Low Income Housing Coalition shows D.C. residents must earn more than $34 an hour, that's more than twice the city's minimum wage, to afford a two-bedroom home with rent as high as $1,800 a month. Washington's mayor, Muriel Bowser, is plowing more than $500 million into her plan to create 12,000 affordable housing units in the city by 2025, with a push into affluent neighborhoods.
Benitier says one challenge in building that much housing is resistance from wealthier residents.
You know, you have folks who've got, you know, $700,000, at the time, $700,000 condos, and they were concerned about what my building would do, if anything, to their property values and the type of clientele that I would be.
So it's kind of a, there goes the neighborhood.
Yeah, so, you know, precisely, right? And you know, look, we live in an urban city. Everybody of every walk of life, of every creed, race, or nationality should be able to reside in an urban city such as ours. And it should not just be exclusive to one group of or type of people. And, you know, we had to sort of go through that and reassure people.
Benitier takes our team on a drive through the city to one of his construction sites. Pointing to previous projects along the way, he says he'd like to see more mixed-income neighborhoods.
When you drive through the streets of Washington, D.C., what does it feel like to know that you're actually helping to change the skyline of the city?
It feels great. It feels great. I got to tell you, it never gets old. Yeah, and it's weird because, you know, I wouldn't lie to you, like, there are moments when I'm in the car and I can be in a car with, like, especially my friends of mine who are not from here. Right. And it's like, okay, do you or do you not?
Right.
Do you or do you not say anything?
We arrive at the site of a new development downtown. 140 affordable apartments. Benitier's construction team bring him up to date on their progress. Benitier says he still gets goosebumps thinking about what he has accomplished for this American city, for its residents, and for himself.
I still have a huge sense of gratitude waking up every morning, no different than the first day I arrived here. And I tell my friends now, and the same I'm going to tell you, that I firmly believe, like I did then, like I did when I was in Lagos, when I arrived and when I am today, that the streets of America are paved with gold. I firmly, wholeheartedly believe that that's the case. So if the streets are paved with gold, then I just have to figure out a way to get a shovel. And
put a building on that street.
Right. And I still feel that way. I still feel extreme sense of gratitude.
Perhaps the greatest foundation Benitier could ever have built on are the lessons from his African parents about the power of hard work, perseverance, and optimism.
There's one thing that we all possess as immigrants in this country, which is our strong work ethic. I think it's unmatched. It's something that is just innate in us. So to be able to say that there isn't any work, any kind of work for you to do, it's very hard to believe, frankly, as far as I'm concerned. Because whatever kind of odd jobs you can think of, I think I've had my share. I've done my share. It's because the truth of the matter, particularly in a place like America, and this came directly from my dad, America rewards hard work, bottom line. And it's true. And I've seen it, I've experienced it, and I'm still experiencing it till this very day.
And that is our show this week. Thank you to my VOA colleagues who helped me bring you this episode. Also a huge thanks to our affiliate stations now airing the show across the African continent. And as always, thank you for your company on television, radio, and online. Until the next time, goodbye.